Well, that's it. The economy is officially on its own till after the election. The president said so today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Tuesday today, the 6th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has been a good long while since we started this program, or in fact anywhere in it, quoted a tweet from the President of the United States. But then today, mid-afternoon on the East Coast, that is, while the markets were still open, came this from the presidential Twitter account. I have instructed my representatives to stop negotiating until after the election, when, immediately after I win, we will pass a major stimulus bill that focuses on hardworking Americans and small businesses. So the way you decide who wins, of course, is to actually have the election. But the point of what he says is that there's no more stimulus coming for this economy for at least a month, probably much longer if we're honest. An economy where 850,000 people, it has to be said, are losing their jobs every single week. 12.5 million people are unemployed, and 27 million people are on some kind of government unemployment assistance. The number of ways this decision is going to trickle down through this economy, negotiating tactic or not, as some pundits are saying, the number of ways it trickles is big. But don't take it from me, because Fed Chair Jay Powell gave a speech today to the National Association for Business Economics, a speech to which the president clearly didn't listen, because Powell was pretty clear-eyed about things.
The expansion is still far from complete.
Go on.
At this early stage, I would argue that the risks of policy intervention are still asymmetric.
Hang on, he's going to explain.
Too little support would lead to a weak recovery, creating unnecessary hardship for households and businesses. Over time, household insolvencies and business bankruptcies would rise, harming the productive capacity of the economy and holding back wage growth.
All of which are bad. And on the other hand,
by contrast, the risks of overdoing it seem, for now, to be smaller. Even if policy actions ultimately prove to be greater than needed, they will not go to waste.
And here is this classic strong Jay Powell finish.
The recovery will be stronger and move faster if monetary policy and fiscal policy continue to work side by side to provide support to the economy until it is clearly out of the woods.
Monetary policy, of course, is the Fed and interest rates. Fiscal policy is Congress and the White House spending. Or not spending. The two sides, by the way, the White House and Democrats in the House of Representatives, should say here that the Dems have already passed a bill. Anyway, the two sides are about $800 billion, maybe $1 trillion apart. And you remember last week when we started talking about how the easy part of this recovery is done? This is pretty much what we were talking about. All right, spare a thought here. Well, spare a thought for millions of people trying to get by in this economy right now, but also for the state and local governments that deliver a lot of the services and provide a lot of the support on the ground. Because as we have been reporting, they are looking at huge budget gaps and have been counting on this federal help. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
That state and local governments need help paying for things like unemployment benefits, education, public health, that is not in dispute for the most part.
These are incredibly important services that are being provided to people and helping people through this really difficult time.
Julia Wolf is with the Economic Policy Institute. The main sticking point is over how much money to give. Republicans are inclined to offer $200 to $400 billion. Democrats have asked for $900 billion.
It's one of the more obvious examples of an attempt to inflate state budgets beyond any reasonable measure of actual need.
That's Adam Michelle with the Heritage Foundation. Republicans point to hundreds of billions in COVID-related aid that's already been passed and argue states should cut pensions, freeze pay, dip into rainy day funds. Irma Esparza-Diggs is with the National League of Cities. She says many hard-hit cities are already doing some of that.
Some are seeing as high as up to a 50% decline in their sources of revenues.
She estimates cities alone will need $360 billion over the next 3 years. Timing is another issue, says Stan Voiger with the American Enterprise Institute.
You know, should we provide funding to state and local governments or for the coming fiscal year, or should we give them money for the year after that as well?
Fed Chair Jerome Powell, appointed by President Trump, has said the risks of overspending are outweighed by the risks of not spending enough. President Trump tweeted this afternoon, that his administration will stop negotiating any relief package until after the election. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
One does wonder, for a person as fixated on the stock market as he is, why the president didn't wait until after the close today to pull the rug out from under relief negotiations, because traders, well, they can read his tweets too, you know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, fine. We hear you. Some good economic news, please, you say? Well, here is some. The Census Bureau told us this morning the trade gap, the trade deficit, grew in August to the biggest it's been in 14 years. We bought a bunch more from overseas than we sold. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains what's going on here.
The fact that imports to the U.S. are rising says a lot about how far the economy's come since the start of the pandemic, says Ishwar Prasad, a professor of trade policy at Cornell.
Economic recoveries are usually associated with increases in demand for goods and services produced both domestically and abroad.
That increasing demand for imports is a sign that consumers have more purchasing power. Emily Blanchard is a professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College.
It's a sign of rising consumer confidence. It's a sign that firms are buying imported inputs that they may need to produce things that will become tomorrow's exports.
Harvard economist Ken Rogoff says the trade gap is widening because exports are not rising as quickly as imports, and that could complicate the recovery.
We need the rest of the world to demand more of our stuff to help our recovery.
This month's gap is a sign that the U.S. is recovering faster than many of the countries we trade with. Rogoff says the U.S. could lose that lead if job gains taper off, if a second stimulus package never arrives, or if the virus picks up again.
I expect in the next few months our recovery is going to slow down quite a bit.
Still, there are reasons to be optimistic about exports in the long run. Emily Blanchard at Dartmouth says the U.S. is a net exporter of services, such as travel, financial, and digital services.
This is great. This is a source of comparative advantage. And so if that means that we produce fewer t-shirts in the United States, then I think that's probably okay.
Blanchard says COVID-19 has made American digital services, say cloud computing and video conferencing, even more valuable. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Tomorrow morning and every weekday morning, don't miss the Marketplace Morning Report. David Brancaccio and the early crew setting you up for your economic day. Economy and business centric though we are, come on, everything is politics right now, and more people than ever want to be political in this moment and are willing to spend on it. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, this election, the whole thing, not just the top of the ticket, is probably going to wind up costing almost $11 billion. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports on one slice of the donor base that is getting bigger.
Big money donors still play the biggest role in funding campaigns. Just 100 people have contributed 8% of the money in this race. But according to the Center for Responsive Politics, donors who give less than $200 are starting to catch up.
They've contributed 22% of all donations so far, which is much larger than in previous cycles.
Sarah Briner is research director for the CRP. She says that's up from 14% 4 years ago. This year's small dollar total will be almost $2 billion, which
is a lot of money coming from people who have been affected by the pandemic, by the recession.
And also despite the pandemic putting a damper on traditional fundraising events.
I think that it just goes to show how concerned people are going into this election.
Another reason for the rise of the small dollar donor? Technology. Online donation platforms aren't limited by lockdowns.
It's much easier to give now. Act Blue on the Democratic side and increasingly Win Red on the Republican side have made it very easy for somebody to give $5 or $10 to a candidate.
David Primo teaches political science and business administration at the University of Rochester.
And small donations are now in the billions of dollars. And that's not something we would have seen a decade ago.
Back then, small dollar donors played a much smaller role. This year, they're giving more than PACs and super PACs combined. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
that struggle reminds us how much of a civil right marriage is.
How love and marriage and race factor into this economy. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, like I said, traders saw those tweets from the president and pretty much packed it in. Dow Industrial's down 375, 1.3%, closed at 27,772. Ought to tell you, though, it was like a 600-point drop on the Dow because they were way up for the day until. The NASDAQ down as well, 177 points, 1.5%, 1.5%, 11,154. The S&P 500 took a dip, 47 points, 1.3%, 33.60. Sabrina was telling us about states and their economies. A couple of states, Colorado, New York, already projecting their revenue is going to drop next year by close to 20%. That is according to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This has been a terrible year for a lot of things, for people and for businesses, for whole industries as well. California's wine industry among them. It started with a grape glut earlier this year. Then the coronavirus cut into sales. And now all the fires you've been hearing about have damaged or destroyed property at more than a dozen wineries in Napa. And grapes could wind up being smoke damaged, all of which are threatening the livelihoods of tens of thousands of winery workers, as KQED's Sam Harnett reports.
Here's how Guillermo Herrera sums it up.
It's one thing after another, man. 2020 is the worst year I've ever seen in my life, and I've been doing this for over 20 years.
Herrera and his wife, Angelica, run the Gerencia de Valle Company in the Napa Valley. They have a crew of up to 100 workers to manage vineyards for other wineries. His workers are loading up boxes to harvest grapes. The growers want them picked before they get too much exposure to smoke. Yeah. Smoke taint, as it's called in the industry, can ruin wine. And with about 4 million acres already burned in California this year, there has been a lot of smoke. This is endangering the livelihoods of the workers in the industry. Some 65,000 people, according to the Wine Institute, a California-based advocacy group.
Everybody's spooked. Everybody's spooked.
Many winemakers are refusing to buy grapes from growers, or they're leaving their own grapes on the vine with the hope of collecting insurance money if the grapes are found to have smoke taint. This means people doing the harvesting are out of work.
I'm getting calls left and right, day in, day out, of folks looking to work. The amount of grapes that have been rejected is just, you know, five or six of my clients are not going to pick any of their fruit this year. Zero.
In the vast majority of cases, these grapes will make great wine.
John Aguirre is president of the California Association of Wine Grape Growers. Grapes can actually be tested for smoke taint, but Aguirre says it can take 30 days to get results.
There isn't the ability to do testing and get results in a real-time basis to make decisions.
All the smoke comes on the heels of COVID. An analysis by Aguirre's association calculates that the pandemic has already caused $400 million in losses for a grape crop that's usually worth $4 billion. The association estimates that smoke could do just as much damage or even more.
It's going to be tough. It was difficult this year. I think it's going to be worse next year.
Enrique Lopez has a wine brand called Encanto Vineyards based in St. Helena. He also employs up to 100 people to harvest grapes. His crew got hit hard by COVID.
First, our supervisor, main supervisor, got in April, got the COVID. And then after that, there was one of our, another foreman got a positive.
Lopez says he pays workers to quarantine if they feel sick. In August, his own family became ill.
My wife, my little one, which is 9 months, was 9 months. My mother-in-law, who's here visiting, everybody got COVID.
Back in the field, fellow vineyard manager Guillermo Herrera is about to head out to harvest. He and his crew are now wearing masks both for the smoke and a deadly virus that attacks the respiratory system.
We have to make sure that our crop is saved and that we can continue to work that crop so that we can eat and we can feed our families.
Herrera says his priority right now is to make sure his employees have work. He's taking jobs at lower pay for growers without insurance policies who are hoping to salvage their grapes before the chance of any more smoke damage. In the Napa Valley, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Justin Ho was talking about the trade deficit a couple of minutes ago. Earlier this year, we told you about a different kind of trading that had made a comeback when the pandemic hit. Good old-fashioned bartering. Veronica Kuhn started a Facebook barter group back in March to help people trade hand sanitizer and cleaning products and other stuff that was in high demand back then but in low supply. We called her back up the other day.
So with the barter group today, it's a little bit different than it was when it started. Right now, people are looking for more personal home items that they need. Like some people are putting up patio furniture, or I'm looking for a swimming pool, and this is what I have to barter, you know. And before it was like, you know, hand sanitizers and stuff like that that we needed during the pandemic, diapers. It's just changed a little bit. More of the stuff on there is about grocery stores and what they have available, and still a lot of food distribution sites that people are sharing so that people can still get food. The most asked for things in our group have been face masks and cleaning supplies. The face masks haven't really left the group. They've slowed down, but a lot of times the people are willing to trade. Like, I have paper towels, or I have toilet paper, I need this. Or even as much as saying, I have clothes that I'm not wearing anymore that don't fit, and I'm willing to trade for the disinfectant wipes and disinfectant sprays. I try to go on once a week into the Facebook group and just post, how is everyone doing? And I feel it's important to do that, not just as somebody who started the group, but as somebody who really cares. So I asked last week how people were doing, and more people on there were doing good or great, as opposed to the people still struggling. We only had a handful of people that were going through some hard times or in need of things. And so it made me feel good that there was less people in need. My business with doing hair has been great. Like, nothing has really slowed down. I've had to cut back my hours just because I was working too many hours and spending too much time at the salon just to get everybody in. And it's really hard. It's hard to breathe with the chemicals that we use and stuff, having to wear a mask. And I understand it. It's not that I don't understand it. It's just, it's difficult. I wish that we can just get back to normal.
You and me both, Veronica. You and me both. Back to normal. That is Veronica Kuhn. She's in Henderson, Nevada. You can tell us what's happening in your economy. We'd love it if you would. Marketplace.org/myeconomy. We got the September jobs report last Friday, as you know, because you were listening. And in it, we learned the overall unemployment rate in this economy has fallen to 7.9%. For black women, though, the jobless rate is more than 11%. That's on top of a race and gender wage gap, which has black women earning 62 cents on the dollar that white men earned last year. There's also a gap in the matrimony economy, where historically black women are less likely to be married than women in other groups. Emory University professor Diane Stewart has a new book out on that topic. It's called Black Women, Black Love. Professor Stewart, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Kai.
I want to get into the economics of what you have written in this book, because we've been doing a lot of work on that lately, about black women and economic empowerment in this economy. But I want to talk about one of the through lines of what you write about, which is that it's a civil rights issue. This issue of black women and their ability tendency to marry is what you call the least covered or least understood civil rights issue in America.
Yes, I do. When we really think through some of the most recent struggles for marriage, for example, LGBTQ rights, That struggle reminds us how much of a civil right marriage is. And so when we look at also the Supreme Court justices who've ruled since 1888 on over a dozen cases that affirm marriage as a civil right, we can begin to look at Black women's low marriage rates in a different way than we normally look at them. We often tend to treat the problem in the public eye as a personal problem. But when we look at the numbers nationally, we have to then look at this as a civil rights issue. That's the way I see it.
Okay, so let's take a turn to the marketplace of this now, because you are not at all sure. In fact, you kind of are sure, and you say this in the book. You don't believe that increasing the rate at which Black women in this economy marry would improve their economic standing and reduce economic inequality.
Well, there are studies that show that when tax laws burden families, American families, married couples in particular, they burden Black married couples more. There are laws that show, there are studies that show that Black marriage doesn't so much increase wealth. It's more so that we have to build wealth to increase Black marriage, if that makes sense. It's not so much that getting married as a Black person builds so much wealth. Certainly, it probably aids people in their individual struggles and goals on a daily basis. But it's not so much that that builds wealth as much as we need to build wealth so that Black women will marry more.
Which is especially problematical because you point out elsewhere in this book that inherited wealthlessness of Black families and Black women and Black men individually is a huge issue. In this.
That's right. That's something that totally shocked me. I had no idea that I would leave the research feeling that building wealth was the most important strategy that we need to pursue to overcome this problem. But I'm absolutely convinced of that now. I mean, we already know that today a lot of young people don't get married across racial boundaries because of a lack of wealth. When we look at the fact that most Black families have a dime for every dollar of wealth a white family has, or when we look at the fact that white single family homes are more wealthy than Black coupled homes, we can understand how that would be a serious deterrent for Black people.
Let me get you then on the way out here, Professor, to the title of your book. It's Black Women, Black Love. And I want to flip that a little bit. We've been hearing a lot about Black capitalism on the program the past number of months. And I've been asking people what they think the future of Black capitalism is. And they're reasonably hopeful. And I wonder what you think of the future of Black love, given the economic situation that we've just described.
I feel more hopeful than I ever have, but I also fear that we often take two steps forward and one step back, or even three steps back. And so I think the best way to see our hopes addressed is for Black people and other people who care about Black women and Black families in America to place this issue on the civil rights agenda, which we have never done in the past.
It's a book called Black Women, Black Love from Diane Stewart. She's a professor of religion and African-American studies at Emory University. Professor, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've got an excerpt from Professor Stewart's book, a part about what it's like for Black women with partners who are incarcerated and the costs they face. It's at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, kind of a corollary to that occasional update I do on how many passengers the TSA is screening compared to a year ago. Not many, relatively speaking, is the news, which is not good on a lot of levels, especially if you are a plane maker. Boeing said today it's cutting its manufacturing forecast for the next decade. Figures it's going to sell 11% fewer planes over the next 10 years than it was estimating a year ago. Also, and not for nothing, also torpedoed by the president's no more negotiations tweet today, help for airlines and the 30,000 people they have said they are going to be furloughing. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context on a Tuesday of a theme with where we started. Fed Chair Jay Powell talking about the recovery and how tentative and unequal it is. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal. They were using Department of Labor data. People with bachelor's degrees or higher, they've basically gotten back all the jobs they lost earlier this year. People without a high school diploma, though, still 18% fewer jobs in that group. Okay, now we're really leaving. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufukme Matolu, Olga Oxman, Beth Perlman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.